When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this latest edition of Screen Talk. I'm in LA in a weird location because there was a fire at my apartment. So there's smoke damage, which I wouldn't wish on anyone. And Ryan Latanzio is in New York as usual. I was in New York and I had a great time and I ran around and saw four plays. So now I'm back in LA.
Last week, Kate and I talked about two movies, and one of the reasons, well, you were traveling also, but one of the reasons that we had you sit it out was because you had not seen either of them, and they were the talk of the week. So why don't you first talk about your feelings about Challengers?
Because I caught COVID during all of my theater going, and I ended up down and out during the time that I was going to see Civil War and Challengers. But I've caught up with them both. And Challengers is a lot of fun. And one of the reasons that it's so delicious is that it fills a hunger. We are not given movies about sex. It just isn't done. It is a widely regarded canard in the movie business that audiences don't like sex at the movies. I would like to argue with this.
I think they do.
From the audience I saw it with, which was the premiere audience in Westwood. Yeah, you know, it is. If you have three hugely attractive actors, and also not just attractive, but carefully picked, I think, by Guadagnino for their abilities. You know, they had to be athletic, they had to be sexy, and they had to be able to handle these intimate, dynamic power struggle scenes. It's a triangle. And the peak moment that you all have seen in the trailer involves the three of them together. For the first time, it's the first time they're having sex. And Zendaya is getting, the character played by Zendaya, is getting a huge kick out of the fact that these two guys are both besotted with her. They're like puppy dogs with their tongues hanging out, you know? And then there's this moment where she's sitting on the bed and she's, so who's gonna, you know, be the one? And they both leap onto the bed next to her on either side of her and proceed to have sex with her and each other.
But wait, but there's no actual sex in this movie. It's just them kissing. There's no penetrative oral digital sex. There is actually no genitals involved in this film. Although I looked at the shooting script because they offered that among the press materials, and there actually was some more explicit moments that did not make it into the movie.
Yeah, Zendaya made a big point of that on the red carpet. She was like, you think you saw sex, but you really didn't. We saw sex. Let me put it another way, because sex isn't just genital penetration.
No.
They were.
I would argue in that moment, they are not really having any kind of sex.
They're leading their way toward it.
Toward it.
It's the foreplay. They're having foreplay.
Exactly, foreplay. It's foreplay.
And there's
the
this
whole
great
movie
moment
is foreplay,
where the two men are kissing, and it's really hot. It's really, and she's watching them, and she's like, you know, really enjoying it and happy for them. So that is an underlying theme also throughout, is this understanding that the two men, not only were their boyhood friends, but there's an intense attraction between them as well as competition. It's a very interesting movie. It's nasty. It's dark. It isn't a necessary. Luca Guadagnino isn't necessarily just giving us something superficial. There's an underlying theme about what is love.
Yeah, this movie had me craving a psychosexual tailspin. It just seemed like they were having a good time in all of their entanglements. And I also think it really, in a way, it announces Josh O'Connor to probably a lot of people who didn't see The Crown Who didn't see God's
God's
Own
Own
Country,
Country.
things like that, as a sort of louche leading man. You know,
Or La
he's sort
Chimera,
of.
which is out now.
Right. He has a disheveled appeal in this movie that is hard to resist. And I think that anyone that who the person who walks away with the movie is subjective, but I feel that the movie is strongly built around Josh O'Connor to the point where I felt like even Guadagnino's camera desires Josh O'Connor. And we know from other Guadagnino movies that his camera often is dictating the filmmaker's own attraction to his lead.
What's interesting about it is that Josh O'Connor is, in fact, if you want to pick a type, he's playing the bad boy. And she marries Mike Faist, right? So she marries him. In a way, he's the good boy, and he's the one who's working hard and being successful on the tennis circuit, and she's his coach.
But
He
it's like, who are you going
keeps
to go for?
being
Of
drawn back in. To
course,
the
because
bad boy. And it's and
you're
we know
always
it and we get it completely,
no, because
100%.
we're always drawn to the guy who with no money in his bank account that you want to set your life on fire for.
So did he establish perhaps that he was doing drugs? Did he show us a sort of bruised inner arm? Did you see that? Or did I make that up?
I don't recall drugs being involved. Like, you mean if there was steroidal use or something
No, he
or
showed,
anything?
like a bruised inner arm, but I wasn't
Huh.
sure if that was what he was showing us.
Well, I will see it again. And so I will look closer. In fact, I will see it again for, I think the one flaw of the movie is, in some ways, I feel like there's so many Chirons in this movie. Like, we're constantly 3 days ago
Right, take
last
us back
year,
and
9 years
forth in
later.
time. Yeah.
There were at least a couple moments where I was like, I don't know where we are right now. I really couldn't tell. And no, like, ch slight change in the hair kind of made a different help destabilize me in those moments.
Yeah, it had a lot to do with how much beard Josh had. But no, I really liked the movie. It's hugely entertaining, and I'm curious to see how well it does at the box office. Now, there are those who are so enthusiastic about it that they think it's an Oscar contender. And I remember looking at it when they moved it back during the pandemic, during the strikes. I remember thinking, this doesn't really look like a big deal Oscar movie anyway. It's probably a smart move, and I'm going to stick with that. We're in April. It's a long, long way off. They could maybe, if there isn't much competition, eke out a screenplay nomination, maybe, but I or score or something. But I don't really know.
There may not be a lot of competition, though. I mean, we are kind of staring down the barrel of a dearth of material due to the strikes just compared to last year. So if any year where it could sneak in somehow, this could be it. It's too bad that this movie didn't.
What about Civil War? What do you think about that one being an Oscar
Well,
contender?
again, I think it's April and it's a divisive movie in a lot of ways, and it's a cold movie. You don't feel endeared really to anyone on screen or
I
sort of
disagree with
attached to
that
their
completely.
motivations.
I
Okay. All
completely
right. Well,
disagree with
I
that.
talked about it a lot last week, so you talk about it.
I heard you and Kate. You were very good. So I would say I was expecting to like it less than I did. And it was beautifully made. It is a gorgeously wrought movie. And it's very interesting the point of view that he adopts, which is to follow the journalists. And so you've got the sort of Lee Miller type, that's her name, but she's also based on this real other wartime photographer played by Kirsten Dunst. And it's interesting to see her playing her age, and playing an older woman, a veteran. And she and then you've got Wagner Moura, who I adored in this. I thought he was quite charming and fun to watch. And he's the writer journalist and sort of the leader of the group. And then the young Kaylee Spahn is going along for it. It reminded me of The Last of Us, Ryan. It reminded me of a road movie that's going from place to place to place with new challenges in terms of survival in each location. That's what it is. It's a war instead of
Well,
zombies,
that's a good comparison because it is like almost like a video game in that way. It reminded me of that. almost. And no, I
It's
agree
very
with you.
similar. Yeah. So you end up, they go through each harrowing episode and drop off various people along the way. One of the harrowing episodes is the one with Jesse Plemons, which was pretty upsetting. And he's the only one, the only character that is evincing a specific political agenda, if you like. So a lot of criticism of the movie has to do with the fact that it's not political. It hasn't figured out the backstory on why there's a. I don't think that matters. Why there's a civil war? Who's on what side? It doesn't matter. War is war. It doesn't matter who's what their reasons are or how it came to be. Whether we would agree with the politics of the guy in the White House, the president, played by Nick Offerman. Who's also in The Last of Us? No, I had no problem with that. I actually thought the movie was sort of simple in its structure and its setup. And it's about the journalists covering the event and what it does to them. And I was very caught up in the Kirsten Dunst character. I completely identified with her and her concern for the younger journalist who doesn't know what she's doing. I
Her
thought it
maybe
was.
most of all. Yeah. I mean, he the I think the issue has, well, the issue for Alex Garland has been that he can't seem to explain his own movie, but I don't think that he should have to. We're just in a moment
No,
where
he's
people
terrible at
want,
explaining it.
he's really bad at that, and he was bad at that with Men. It worked for Annihilation because that movie left you feeling like you had some kind of otherworldly encounter. And so how would you possibly be able to explain that? We're just in a time where people want really like binary moral proclamations. And so it's been a bitter pill, I know, for a lot of people, non-industry audiences, friends I know who've seen it, to swallow that they felt like the movie didn't have anything concrete to say, that it's sort of this nebulous political commentary without really biting into it, any of it. And I agree that the Jesse Plemons character is probably the door into understanding at least this the schism in terms of race that has happened, because this is a white nationalist that this guy's playing, basically, executing a series of race-motivated murders. But a lot of that is sort of ambient noise in the background, and it is mostly, it's like you are on the ground with these four people.
But it was beautifully made, Ryan. It was a gorgeous movie. The actors are terrific. And he's really giving us a portrait of the people watching the war so that we can see what the impact of the war is. And, you know, war is bad. And he kept it simple, is what he did. And I think he did that for a reason, which was to stay out of it, to stay out of that debate. He didn't want to have it.
Yeah, it's just interesting that it's coming out in an election year, and that's not necessarily what he planned for. And he keeps being asked about that and kind of fumbling the answer, but I don't know why he should necessarily have to answer to that. Obviously, people, you know, obviously he did something right if the people are responding at all, even negatively at all. And it was the biggest opening for A24 ever, opening weekend at 25 million. We'll see where it. You got, I don't remember the
It
cinema
doesn't
score.
have
It
a good
wasn't
cinema
super
score.
high.
No,
No,
it was
no.
very low, like B minus or something. It's also a question of how they marketed it. So they marketed it effectively, obviously, but if the audience didn't like it and didn't enjoy it, then it will fall off eventually. So then CinemaCon occurred, and I always do this. Sometimes I go. I used to go to CinemaCon every year, and one of the reasons I loved to go, even though it was Las Vegas and it was gross and the food was terrible, and you always ended up with an upset stomach from the rubber chicken. But it was really always fascinating to be on the ground with all the theater owners and sort of hear what was going on. And I always loved the dog and pony shows where the studios bring all the people in and make presentations. And so what you do when you watch from afar is glean from what all the reporters say and all the clips and all the, sometimes they don't give you the trailers. They only show them in the room. But so we did glean that, for example, Inside Out 2 is going to be a big deal. Maybe can't Kinds of Kindness. We would like to see that happen. You know, we're going to see that at Cannes, you know, the Searchlight, Yorgos Lanthimos, Emma Stone movie, and maybe Gladiator 2 will be a big deal. It could be. It has an opportunity to be. Ridley Scott and Paul Mescal and so on. I really can't wait to see Nosferatu and Conclave. These are more on the specialty side at Focus.
Focus, yeah.
Right, we're over in Universal Land now. And then Warner Brothers has Joker, Folie à Deux, which could be great. The first one was great. It was.
That'll be a Venice for sure, because the first one won the Golden Lion, and
And
just
they're
that
not
seems like
going
an
to, you know, miss that
inevitability.
opportunity, right? And I'm curious about the Kevin Costner Horizon. Look at the title, though. The Horizon title is Horizon, an American Saga, Episode One.
Yeah, it's two movies. I'm curious about this, and this will be at Cannes, which is interesting. I'm curious to know. My interest is limited in this movie just because of my personal taste, but
Well, are you into Westerns at
no,
all?
not I'm not into contemporary Westerns so much. I will say that. I'm more into
And you didn't
old
watch
Hollywood classic
Yellowstone or any of
Westerns.
that
No, and
stuff.
so I'm wondering, is this like Yellowstone the movie? Is it aimed for that same demographic?
Well,
Like,
he
is my
knows that
grandma going
that
to be
fan
calling
base.
me? I want to watch this Horizon movie.
We'll see. We'll see if that fan base is there for him. I think this is typical. I'm looking forward to possibly talking to Kevin Costner at Cannes. We'll see if that happens. I think, you know, having done Dances with Wolves and won the Oscar with that, he thinks he's good at Westerns and he wants to show what he can do. He must have been very frustrated just acting in the Tyler in the Sheridan series. You know, it went on for what, five, six seasons? I mean, it's endless. So, and he basically abandoned ship
He
and
stormed off
regret
the project and was
and said,
apparently
"I'm
very
done. I'm
ornery.
going to go do this other thing." It's possible that they will get him back, that they'll make some deal with him. He's not closed the door, but they would
It
have to pay him very well.
kind of seems like his departure has effectively killed that show in a bit. It has
It
not
was
been back in a
done.
while.
It was probably done, but we'll see. We'll see how they kill him off. We'll see what they do. And then finally, the studio that came out. I mean, Warner Brothers also has Furiosa, which is exciting. The last Fury Road movie got 10 Oscar nominations. George Miller. We'll see if this is up to the same level. You never know. I can't wait. I cannot wait. And then we have Universal at the end of the day with Wicked, which I need to see that one to know whether they pull that off
Wicked
finally.
Part One, because the next movie is not for another year and a half.
So they waited a long time to make this because it was still touring. And so again, there's a huge fan base for this. But I'm curious to see how it plays. But it played well in CinemaCon. Did you pick up anything else from CinemaCon?
Well, there's a couple animation-related titles that stood out. The Wild Robot, this Universal kind of Wall-E-inspired animated movie directed by Chris Sanders that executives are touting very highly. People in the room loved the footage. It looks interesting. And then, of course, Barry Jenkins revealed a bit of his live-action Mufasa Lion King sequel movie. I'm hoping getting that right, that it's the sequel. It doesn't have the songs in it that we were used to, so it seems like a bit of a gamble. And I guess we'll find out if it was a cash grab, how much of a cash grab this was. I mean, he said, just in the car, I wasn't there, but in the coverage I read, he said he was surprised even to be taking on this project. And if you look beneath the, underneath the hood of what he's saying there, that it could mean a couple different things.
Well, he also said that it deeply moved him when he found himself actually making the movie. So who knows? There may be reasons why Barry related to the underlying material. Okay, so that's the bottom line, though, is that even though there's a list of movies that we are looking forward to and that people seem to respond to very well, it's still not enough movies. And so we are in a situation where the box office is down. Even when A24's obviously Civil War did well, or you know, some other movies have performed beyond their expectations, it's not enough. There's just not enough product. And they were just begging, the theater owners were just begging for, give us more modest product, more diverse product. You don't have to have polls.
I mean, the big movies coming up in the next few months are familiar, like Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes without Andy Serkis. I mean, we know. I mean, even I, this movie kind of crept up on me because I kind of wasn't, you know what I mean? It might not be on your radar because it's just seems so familiar,
Yeah, we talked
recognizable.
about all the sequels and all the, prequels and sequels and remakes that are coming up. So we'll see. We'll see how the theaters hang in there. So there's news on the film festival front, which is that Sundance is doing something we expected them to do, which is that they're doing due diligence on what other opportunities are out there besides doing the festival, mounting the festival. The contract runs out in 2027 in Park City, Utah, which, as we all know, can't handle the festival anymore, is overloaded, is charging people fortunes. And everybody, it was interesting online, a lot of the reaction was, get the hell out of Dodge. It really was. It was like, let's go somewhere that we can afford. So they've done a lot in Salt Lake City. They've expanded their footprint there. That's an option. They could go to Salt Lake City and just, you know, take over the town. I don't know if it would be as sexy, but the problem with Park City is that it's in ski season. And so they're competing. They may make a deal with Park City by the, you know, by the deadline. It is up to them to show that they could go to locations when they moved the workshops to other places. So they've started the process.
And they, you know, they had, I don't remember what those cities were off the top of my head, but they had success in COVID when they were forced to sort of disseminate to bring the festival to other cities. Salt Lake is one where, you know, it's not part of their contract with Park City. So they've, you know, they've always been able to take their titles on the road. But yeah, I do think that the scale of Sundance has gotten too big for, well, it wouldn't be too big for Park City if it weren't for the fact that there are three ski resorts also in Park City. And everyone is, you know, rubbing elbows, both the skiers and the festival attendees, you know, the entire time. But I wonder how seriously do you think they are taking this search? Because in the messaging, Sundance has really stressed that it's an exploratory measure, but they've set these certain deadlines where basically they've announced this sort of open call for other American cities to raise their hand and express interest in hosting the festival. And basically they said by the end of this year, they will announce what the location is, and it could be Park City still. It could.
That's right. You got it right. I think that this puts pressure on Park City to change some of the terms of their deal. That's part of what they're doing. Is saying, we don't have to do this. We can go somewhere else. Yeah. So that's a leveraging, negotiating ploy. But the cost of the festival is a real issue. And so I think I would love to see them go somewhere else. I really would love to see them go to Salt Lake City. I just think that would be the greatest, like, thumb nose to Park.
Would you not like to see them go somewhere warmer, perhaps?
Or even more glamorous.
Yeah. Watch it. Yeah. Like, it ends up in a parking lot in Los Angeles or something.
But Telluride is the same problem. You know, I mean, it's even if it's in the summer and it's not a ski resort anymore, it's still the demand is such that it drives the prices up and makes it impossible for people to afford. So if you're in a place that has more housing and easier airplane access, it's just going to be cheaper and easier for people to get to.
And also the festival, the last thing I'll say about it is that they're down basically two of the multiplexes where they have all their screenings. Two of them filed for Chapter 11 earlier this year. And so the festival is already heading into a compression to begin with without those venues.
And then very sad news this week was the shuttering of Participant Media. I remember interviewing Jeff Skoll, who was a billionaire, you know, co-founder of eBay, right? And so I remember interviewing him at Sundance the year that they launched An Inconvenient Truth, which ended up being an Oscar winner. So that was a very auspicious launch. And he was so excited about this social action program that he had in mind, and he executed that over all of these years. But even a rich man isn't going to lose money forever. You know, they lose patience eventually.
Yeah, you cannot count on rich people as saviors, because they will want to stop spending money eventually. And that's what happened here.
He talked about a double bottom line, so that he was willing to lose money every year as long as this sort of social action program was being executed and he felt good about the end results. Something happened in the last couple of years. They made fewer movies, but part of it is the change in the marketplace, especially for documentaries, because a lot of the movies they funded were documentaries. And they were very behind some big name documentaries, but along with Roma and Green Book and Spotlight and other bigger films, they didn't pay for those. Those were co-productions. And the participant part of it had a lot to do with going out and reaching out into the community and trying to make an impact, a social impact there. So he gave up. He stopped. He said, "I'm done." And I feel bad, really bad for all the people who were there, who I care about, but also the fact that the good work that they were doing will stop and that the movies they were making will stop. And it's just another nail in the coffin, a bit on the documentary side of.
Well, and on the narrative feature side, the trifecta of movies that they offer, which are movies like Green Book, or maybe I think the last, I would say the last movie that they had, and this was a COVID release that really
Judas.
had impact,
Judas
was
with the black
Judas. Exactly.
sky.
These are mid-budget movies for that are also for awards and that also appeal to like an activist crowd. And there's no interest for those anymore, or there's very limited interest. And they had a feature at Sundance, Rob Peace, directed by Chiwetel Ejiofor. They were one of many production companies on this movie, but it still doesn't have a distributor, and it's along the lines of like a
I wonder
Judas
if
or a
that was
Green
the
Book.
tipping point. That would be an interesting question. I mean, I wish I could talk to Jeff Skoll about it because it would reveal what the scope of the changes in the marketplace were from his point of view. I'd be curious to hear from him on that. But they also lost at some point a few years ago, they lost Diane Wyerman, who is this extraordinary force in
Right.
documentaries. She died of cancer and she really pushed forward a very active agenda of extraordinary movies. All right, so you and I have been enjoying, I think, very much the Steve Zaillian series, Ripley on
Oh, I
Netflix.
finished it. I blew through the whole thing in like a day, like 24 hours.
So what I'm doing, I have a lot of other things I have to watch right now. So what I'm doing is I'm saving it as a dessert, kind of a delicious thing to reward myself with one episode at a time. So I'm about 4 episodes in and really, really enjoying it. So the last episode I saw is maybe it's 3 episodes in. The last episode I saw was the if anybody who saw The Talented Mr. Ripley knows the plot of this series, which basically is this Tom Ripley guy is sent by the father of Dickie Greenleaf, a moneyed, spoiled, delightfully charming guy. He was played by Jude Law in the Anthony Minghella movie.
A rayfish man, I would say.
Dickie, that's just it's everything. His name says it all. Dickie Greenleaf, And he has a ring on this finger that Ripley's very obsessed with. He has an incredible watch. He dresses with panache. There's this awfully upsetting scene where he's out for the day. Dickie's out for the day, and Ripley puts on his clothes, including his underwear. I was sort of taken by this. He goes all the way to from top to bottom, and he's acting out a scene
He
with.
affects his Dickie's voice even. Oh, it's so gruesome. It is. Oh, that seems brutal.
And he's caught. Dickie comes and witnesses this and hears him. It blew my mind, actually, that Dickie didn't just ditch him then and there, but you knew where it was heading. You knew that. So the big scene occurs out on the water on a boat. Dickie reveals that he's basically ditching Ripley for future plans are going to be without him.
I love the forensic detail to Ripley's criminal doings
It was
in the
very blood
show.
simple. It was very blood simple.
There is a later episode, I won't spoil anything, that where the entire episode is basically dedicated to him disposing of a body. I found that I got a huge kick out of that. I think honestly, of the ones I've seen, I think this is the best Netflix original series maybe ever.
Yeah, no. Art, and it has a lot to do with Zaillian because all right, so we know Zaillian. Zaillian is one of the great screenwriters. One of the great adapters. He won an Oscar for Schindler's List. He is, but also a director in his own right. So he's a very, very talented man. And you can tell, you can just see that he put an enormous amount of time and effort into writing this. and directing this and making the decision to put it in black and white, which is a huge decision and a good one because he's focused so directly on the details of the architecture and the framing and the arches and the stairs and all the different ways that the light plays in the on the Amalfi Coast. It's just gorgeous.
But it's not a, in the way that the Anthony Minghella film was, it's not a wealth porn version of Italy. It's very sparse and it sort of looks like it's on the verge of decay. I mean, it's a very romantic vision of it, but it doesn't feel glamorous or lavish in a way that maybe other adaptations have. And the other interesting decision that Zalian made beyond the black and white is to make everyone a little bit older.
That's
The
true.
Matt Damon of the Minghella movie, we
Very
assume is
young.
probably in his mid-20s. And now here we have a Ripley played by Andrew Scott who is in his 40s, and it makes it even creepier.
It does make it creepy. He is a creepy character. There's no question about it. And the way that the black and white works with his eyes, I don't know what they did. I'd like to hear from the cinematographer exactly what they did. But there's something about the blackness, the darkness of his eyes, which tells you. That there is no soul inside that guy.
Right,
He
right.
is a
What the
sociopath.
right. The expression, like his eyes were black. I've never quite understood what that means. And then now I get it. I see it with this guy.
The other show I'm watching, which you are not watching, is
I
Shogun,
know.
which is
For
extreme.
shame.
And the penultimate episode of Shogun, and one of our writers on the at IndieWire has an interview with Justin Marks, the showrunner, about what happened in this next to the last episode, focused on Lady Mariko, played by Anna Sawai, who should win an Emmy. I mean, there's nobody comes close to the performance that this woman gives. But what they do in Shogun that I find so extraordinary is to combine a rather accurate feudal period story, based on the James Clavell, with a more modern view, a more Western approach, so, but without throwing out the baby with the bathwater. They hang on to what's authentic and accurate while giving us a reasonably accessible window in. And so this scene is about. It just comes down to the frustrations this woman has experienced her whole life in terms of not having any agency at all. And she stands up to the lords. She's acting out for Lord Tokunaga, but she's acting out for herself too. It's extraordinary. I hope everybody watches this series.
I'll get back to it. I'm torn in a lot of directions. I watched Ripley. I'm watching The Sympathizer. I'm still trying to finish The Regime, but it'll happen.
The sympathizer is good.
The Sympathizer is great, and it's I mean, it's about a North Vietnam communist spy who is infiltrating South Vietnam and working for the Americans there. And it is as typical of a Park Chan-wook film, has a bravado stylistic, many bravado stylistic flourishes and some pretty incredible set pieces of war. I mean, it looks like a very expensive show.
And
I'm
Downey's good in it.
and Downey is in a lot of prostheses and some kind of hair piece that is very he looks very like unkempt and disheveled in the louche classical sense of a Robert Downey Jr. that we know from something like a Zodiac. It's kind of more along the lines of that performance. He's very good. No, I'm excited to keep watching that one.
But it's fun to be back on with you, Ryan. I missed it. And next week, I won't be here either because I'm traveling again. I'm going up to the San Francisco Film Festival, and you will have Marcus Jones on to actually get into the TV stuff for real as
Which
an
will much be me asking
engineer.
questions and him answering. So
He knows.